everybody. Welcome to this podcast on transfer pricing hot topics. My name is Isabel Verlinde. I'm a transfer pricing partner based in Brussels, and I'm also facilitating our global PwC transfer pricing practice. I have two most distinguished guests with me. So, Andrea?
My name is Andrea Lee. I'm the head of controlling and transfer pricing of Erste Group, which is a banking group.
And we have Gabi as well.
Hello, my name is Gabi Best. I'm a transfer pricing partner in Amsterdam, and I nowadays lead our ITS practice in the Netherlands.
So I'm a bit your moderator for today. So I would like to first hear the perspectives from you, Gabi, on where the world is heading to, how we have to assess geopolitical sort of developments in the current context, and how this affects our day-to-day life as TP transfer pricing practitioners.
Sure, I think we start, of course, if you look at it, we've come from a financial crisis where governments after that clearly were focusing on their treasury budget, so to say. And at the same time, I think a lot of people were, the populations of the countries were affected by the crisis and started, I think, to focus much more on what governments did, but also on whether the multinationals were paying their fair share. And I think with that, we had the BEPS program, a lot of anti-abuse legislation around the world. So you see, I think that's one trend. If you combine that with a trend on digitization, which clearly is affecting all of us around the world, and the need for transparency and the drive for transparency, both fed by governments and society, also on tax payments and paying the fair share. I think that's sort of, if you look at a number of trends which we're facing, and that's resulting in new legislation, that's resulting in governments focusing on their territory, protecting their fair share. I think things like trade wars are a good example of that. We're here today on British Parliament is going to vote on Brexit again, and who knows what the outcome will be and what that will mean for all of us. And I think that makes it quite an uncertain world on the one hand for companies who are, with the help of digitization, also becoming more and more global, where then they're acting in countries which are focusing more and more on their own territory. And that, combined with a lot of new legislation, which also keeps coming, I think we'll talk about the OECD paper on digitization later on. And yeah, change is everywhere, and that just means that we need to be more and more prepared, better prepared, not just have transfer pricing documentation, but also have your systems ready, have your processes right, and be ready to be challenged.
Adding on that, I can confirm that our life as taxpayers is not getting any easier. I do appreciate the work OECD is doing, however, it's adding complexity to our already very complex world. And the fact that if you look at the individual countries that are trying to protect their tax base, that means we are actually facing issues locally where, disregarding what OECD agrees on, the countries react differently, right? And on top of that, we have got not really functioning mutual agreement procedures, and this is the world we live in. The work that OECD is doing now, the direction digitalization, is not going to improve that. So let's see how the world's going to look like for us taxpayers in 1, 2, or 3 years. But we see substantial increase of disputes, substantial increase of burden exactly on the documentation and supporting documentation. And we're now starting new audits in many countries. So let's see where this is going to take us.
We're very happy to have you here, Andrea. We're in Vienna, the nice city of Vienna. Erste Bank, it's an icon on the Austrian market. You only have 24 hours in a day. You already touched on digitization, but there is also the financial transactions, ongoing work of the OECD. But if we look at it from controversy perspective, avoiding controversy or dealing with controversy when it happens. So if there are like a few things that you would say for us to keep in mind in day-to-day managing of your function, what would you think is the most important? Because I want to throw in country-by-country reporting. Financial sector was the first sector confronted with the need to go for country-by-country reporting. So you must have quite some experience with that. We know that countries are now about to digest the information in it since last year in the fall. What's your experience and how do you manage that day to day?
Thank you. If I could give one advice, how we manage is it would be almost like a karma to say document, document, document. This is one thing I've established when I joined the bank to make sure that every decision we make, every meeting where we discuss topics related to transfer pricing is documented in writing. Because it makes it so much easier when audit comes 5 years later, and unfortunately here in Austria we have got quite delayed audits. We just finished 2007, which as you can imagine, 10 years is a long period of time and people usually do not remain that long in their seats. So documentation for me is absolutely crucial, and we make sure that we really document every single decision or discussions we have on that topic. Regarding country by country reporting, that was a very interesting experience. I was involved deeply in the discussions also with OECD, also here locally in Austria. Practically, it was actually quite entertaining because not even Austrian Minister of Finance didn't know how many CBCRs they can expect. They were assuming 20. In my working group of Austrian groups that knew they will have to submit were about 50 entities. At the end, I believe it was around 100. So it was. We had a lot of interesting discussions on CBCR. Practically, you know, if you look at those numbers, and I did present them also at the CFO board, most CFOs do not recognize those numbers because it's added up, it's not consolidated, it's a kind of mixture, actually partially consolidated, unconsolidated. So it's numbers that are very hard to understand for the CFOs of the entities. I believe they are very hard to read. You can hardly make any conclusions, and because CBCR actually doesn't have any clear decisions, you can't even compare CBCRs of different entities because you're comparing apples and pears, right? So I'm really curious how this will be used going forward. We've been publishing as a bank CBCR based on risk directive already for several years. There was no excitement about it, no questions from public. So let's see if the public CBCR based on the BEPS discussions will happen and what impact that would have. Because I can understand that many groups have fear how this data will be understood or misunderstood. But as I said, we didn't make any bad experiences.
It's interesting that you mentioned country-by-country reporting. A lot of clients are talking a lot about CBCR, what their C-suites are telling them about it. But Gabi, we are, as transfer pricing practitioners, we have to file the master file. We have to work on master files that are potentially blueprints of transfer pricing audits, whereas country-by-country reporting is in principle only high-level risk assessment. So are there a few guidelines on master file, value chain analysis that you think are worthwhile sharing?
Wow, yeah, I think I would say at least be aware of what is, for example, on your website. I tend to, if I look at a new client, for example, I typically go to their website and there's most companies nowadays have an About Us section and investor relations presentations on the strategy of the group. And I think ultimately that's where tax authorities would look at as well. And therefore, whatever you put in your master file should at least be in line with what you're publishing on your website and what, because also look at annual reports. If you typically an annual report has a whole section on the strategy of a group, yes. It's quite funny if your master file would not be in line with what is in there. And same, most companies publish who their key competitors are. So actually, I sometimes make the joke that if you have a good About Us section, actually half of the work of the master file is already done.
But just if I can add on that, that's exactly what we do. We take most of the data from our annual report. So you're right, actually, half of our description in master file comes from annual report. And maybe one more comment on master file. We have just opened a new tax audit and Kane requests that they would like to see the master files already based on the new requirements, which we will be handing today over. And I am nervous, to be honest. It's a really compact overview of how our group works, what are the biggest transactions. And my concern is that if tax authorities get it provided this way, the easiest way for them will be to say, well, and now provide me supporting documentation for all of that. That means I need to hire 3 people to start doing the work, because in the size of our organization, and I'm talking 6 billion revenues, 45,000 employees, it's not an easy task, right? We have got all kind of transactions, so document all that on an individual basis is impossible. So let's see how the practical experience will be and where this journey is going to take us.
Yeah, and I think that ultimately, Isabel, what we should keep in mind is that the master file should be linked to your CBCR. It should match with each other. And as you say, you mentioned the word value chain analysis. At the end of the day, I think the value chain analysis is sort of becoming the core of a description of what a company does, and including call it the allocation of the profit in that way, or describing what the key value drivers are. And at the end of the day, you would want to see that back in your master file, but ultimately you want to see that in your CBCR as well. And I must say, I was surprised that I think a lot of companies have paid a lot of attention to table 1 in their CBCR report, but actually most of them didn't pay real attention to table 2. And I've had situations where table 2 mentioned that in a certain country there's a manufacturing function, whereas if you then look at the number of headcounts, it only had 2 people. Well, typically manufacturing is quite difficult with only 2 individuals, and I think ultimately therefore it all needs to come together and match with each other.
Absolutely. This brings us to the last topic for this podcast, and that is digitalization of the economy, dealing with the challenges, the ongoing work of the OECD. So they published a report mid-February, and I think there were like 2,000 pages of comments from over 200 commentators, quite some multinational enterprises, academics, but also professional service providers. Any thoughts you have further to what now the next steps are for the OECD? Because I'm going to take a quick sidestep just as a sort of a reminder to what's in the paper. It's only like 30 pages, so it's not much. 2 pillars. The second pillar I'm going to start with, but this is the pillar that needs some further maturing, because it touches on fundamental principles of international taxation. It's about minimum taxation. Can I, as a country, say that if another country doesn't levy enough taxes, can I say that a certain measure should kick in to impose minimum taxation? And this was borrowed from the US tax reform. We have acronyms like BEAT, guilty, these are acronyms that aren't the most funny ones to be confronted with. But we leave this pillar a bit aside as transfer pricing practitioners. But coming back to the first pillar, there are three sections. One of the sections is, should we expand the notion of marketing intangibles and go beyond a transactional approach to marketing intangibles, to argue that part of the economic rent, part of the residual in an organization, should be attracted to the country where the consumers are. The other is active user participation. If I am a user of an online search machine or I am on social media, I know that my data are captured and that a commercialization is done with my data. That's why I get very tailored advertising on my computer screen. So for this sort of user participation, does that mean also that we have to allocate more profit to the market country? And the third one is significant economic presence. So do we need to enlarge the nexus of a permanent establishment in a certain country? So looking at Andrea and at Gabi here, any thoughts about the proposals on user participation or marketing intangibles?
Well, what fascinates me is that it's presented as a paper on digitization, but if you, especially the point on the marketing intangible, that will basically affect all of us. It's not just the digital companies. Whether you're in a pharmaceutical, consumer goods, or even car manufacturing, I think the more cars you will have in a country driving of your brand may actually mean that you need to allocate more profit to that country, which from a is quite a new concept, of course, given where how we historically looked at these things. So I think that's. You mentioned it's only 30 pages, and the fact that there's 2,000 pages of response says enough in that sense.
Yeah, it definitely challenges everything we've learned and knew the last 30 years. So it will be interesting how this is going to develop further. I'm still not quite sure what impact this may have for us as a bank, which will be interesting, it's a big topic, and I guess we will all wait and see what happens next.
That's absolutely an interesting thought, Andrea. And what I sometimes share with non-fiscal experts, like if the C-suite asks for what is this about, this digitalization paper, then I'm usually telling them, like, BEPS was about increasing the cake, or the Zachertorte, I should say, here in Vienna. So we have increased the cake, so multinationals risk to have to pay more taxes on an overall basis. But now comes the interesting part. It's how we're going to divide the cake. Because now we are talking about allocation of taxing rights to the various countries. And I think, Gabi, you rightfully already hinted to that, like who is going to claim which part of the cake. And then thirdly, the second pillar on minimum taxation, it is a pillar that touches on capital import neutrality after all. So it goes beyond the sort of relevance from a pure tax perspective. So interesting times. So maybe a last question, if I can ask you for your 2 cents of wisdom to share with the audience here. And I would start with Andrea.
Let me think about 2 cents of wisdom. I believe it's important to keep your feet on the ground. And now talking as a practitioner, sitting in an audience of advisors, I have always that feeling that, especially when I come to conferences, that everything we do is wrong and we are not following up with the latest trends, and we need to completely redesign everything we do. But for most of us practitioners, when you come down to your day-to-day jobs, you just need to keep you need to live in reality. That is important. You need to live in the reality. And my feeling is sometimes, or quite often actually, when you look at the discussions and the papers that OECD produces, they live in a virtual reality, and they live in a different world, which I can't even imagine how we can then implement it in a day-to-day business. So stay calm, do your business, it will somehow sort itself out. And the second advice would be really document endlessly. You can't over-document. This is my mantra, and it really proved as a good investment, especially if you in a countries like we are, which is CE countries, that they look more on amounts rather than the quality. So stick to documentation. It's hard to remember what was discussed a year later, or two, or three, or five. So you can't go wrong with that. Gabi?
Yeah, I think as we started, I think we live in a volatile world. It's constantly changing, not just legislation, etc., but I think attitudes of governments. As mentioned, technology is impacting all of us, and I tend to say that of course there are a lot of things which you can't influence, but stay closer at home, look at what you can control, what you can influence, and make sure that what is capable of being controlled on your own wings, try to at least comprehend that and make sure that, as Andrea says, document things, but I think overall also make sure that you know what's going on, that you're connected, that your systems are set up in the right way, because that at the end of the day, there's enough change already which you can't influence, so try at least at home to control what you can.
And if I can add on that, and walk the talk, right? It's very important, especially in the big groups, to make sure that what you're actually putting into your policy, what you're documenting, it's also being lived in the real life.
And that's a fantastic one to end with, Andrea, walk the talk, because this brings me to maybe one suggestion. Take a deep dive in your value chain. Look at what drives your, what we call your economic rent in a day-by-day basis, on a day-by-day basis. Where do we make money? What's important? Whether it's in a digital environment or not, this is going to be important. If we talk about big data, what's the value of raw data? Well, having data on thousands of customers may mean nothing in your commercial activity, unless you can do something with the data that makes your product or service offering better. So it's that sort of value chain analysis. And I do appreciate that the term is used in a lot of instances, and you might feel fatigue for the notion of value chain analysis, but there is really no substitute to do that. So you take a deep dive in the value chain, and then you walk the talk. So with this, I would like to thank my co-panelists here for today. I would like to thank the organizers here in our lovely office in PwC Vienna, and we hope to be able to talk to you soon again. Thank you.